host today, Steve Brown. We have two segments on today's program. In segment one, my guest will be Nicole Neely, and we will talk about a brand new program. It's called Speech First, and they look at issues regarding First Amendment and freedom of speech issues for students at both the university level and in our public schools. And in segment two, I'll speak with Louise Dubay, who's head of an outstanding organization called iCivics that was founded by former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And my guest in segment one of Education Matters today is Nicole Neely, and she is president of Speech First. And first of all, Nicole, welcome to Education Matters.
Thank you for having me on.
First of all, I know your roots are sort of in this general area in the greater Chicagoland area. Where did you grow up and where did you go to school?
Sure. I grew up in Deerfield, so just south of the border in Lake County, Illinois, and I went to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana for my undergraduate degree.
Okay, and you majored in what?
I majored in political science with a minor in French. I have not used the minor very much.
Let's talk a bit about, you know, the organization itself, Speech First. I always want to make sure that our listeners know about the organization and, you know, what the website address is and all that, first of all. And then maybe just talk about how the organization got started, and then we'll drill down and talk about some of the issues and some of the things that the organization is involved in.
Sure. Speech First is a new-ish campus free speech organization. We launched at the end of February this year, and as a membership association, we want to capitalize on the fact that there's a big groundswell of support around the issue of free speech on campus. In a previous life, I ran a group called the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity, which published a site called watchdog.org. We actually had a great reporter in Wisconsin, Matt Kittle, who did a lot of reporting on John McAdams and a lot of other issues across the state. And it struck me, because I was the publisher at the time, you know, you look at the different metrics, and stories, articles about what was going on campus, just all the different hijinks, were always something that interested our readers. They always had really high traffic and great social media pickup. But it was always interesting me to talk to the reporters afterwards and hear the troubles that they had in reporting this. Universities declining Freedom of Information Act requests, no comment, hiding behind FERPA, the Student Privacy Act that was, I think, initially intended to just protect students' Social Security numbers. But now you have universities not providing information about basic operating things. Mm. Because a lot of that information, frankly, is very damning. One story that the watchdog was able to publish that was just caught fire and ended up actually bringing down a university president was the nepotism scandal at the University of Texas mm-hmm. in Austin, mm-hmm. Where the president was getting legislators, friends, and family members into the university. And trustees had asked to see some of the background documents, who got in, why did they get in, and they wouldn't even give the trustees the information about that. They said, well, you know, this is a student privacy issue. And the trustees' response was, well, we have been appointed by the governor to have oversight of this to make sure that, you know, things are operating properly. This is not really a privacy thing. I mean, obviously, university trustees have access to a lot of sensitive financial information. They don't disclose that, but I think FERPA has ended up being weaponized as a way to prevent embarrassing things from getting out mm-hmm. as well. So that mm-hmm. was very discouraging to me. But at Speech First, as a membership association, we defend students' rights on campus primarily through litigation. There are a number of ways that schools have impacted, have trimmed, have diminished students' civil liberties on campus, and be it through security fees for speakers, be it through non-recognition of student groups, the creation of free speech zones. And so we thought there's a lot going on there, and we wanted to join the fight. And so as an association, our cases are filed on behalf of our membership. So our first case, which we filed in May against the University of Michigan, is Speech First versus the school. And, you know, in so doing, we're able to protect students' privacy a little bit. For an individual student to sue his or her school is a very daunting prospect. If your name is out there, if it is Stephen versus the University of Wisconsin, you know that your fellow students are going to give you a little bit of blowback. Your professors will. The school administration will. And at the end of the day, if you still want a diploma, that's a big disincentive. And so if we do it as an association, then it protects the student a little bit more. and we hope then encourages them to come forward. So our membership is open not only to students, but also to concerned citizens, parents, alumni, grandparents, because we really want to show students that there is strength in numbers. And I think also by having a large membership, it does send a very clear message to administrations that these kind of incursions on student rights will no longer be taken.
Mm-hmm. As you look at the kinds of cases and the kinds of reaction that you've gotten from institutions of higher learning across the country, what has surprised you the most so far? I mean, obviously, you've been in existence for 6 months, give or take. But what so far has surprised you the most about the reaction as far as what you are doing, what the organization is doing?
I've gotten from the public, from parents, grandparents, just doing TV. I've gotten nice notes from people saying thank you, because I think there is a real sense of powerlessness out there. You see all these things on the radio or on TV, on radio, on the internet, and you think, how can I make a difference? I mean, if I were to tell the University of Illinois, I'm very disappointed with how you've been dealing with some of these speech issues on campus, they would say, well, you can keep your $50. Have a nice day. You know, I'm not a big enough donor to really make a difference. And if I'm not in school, I mean, it's not that I can sue the school and say, you know, you have violated my rights, because I don't have standing. I'm not in school. What I like about what we're doing at Speech First is it's a way to get a lot of people together and really, create and capitalize on this groundswell of support around the issue in a way that is empowering, because there are so many instances. I mean, I used to think, well, is this a little bit of, you know, is this sound and fury? Is this really an issue? And the more I talk to students and I go to conferences, I think, well, there are just so many little indignities that students face on a regular basis. It's like death by a thousand cuts. And after a while, students do get the message. It's just easier to keep your head down and keep your mouth shut and get through the 4 years. You know what the teachers want you to say? Just write the paper, even if you don't believe in it. And that, I mean, frankly, that's not a real educational experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I went through college, I had terrible ideas and I was 18. But I was challenged and I read and I had passionate debates. And, you know, I have since, you refine your thinking and your ideas over time. And if students aren't exposed to challenging thoughts and different opinions, they don't get the opportunity to do that.
I was reading the article that Paul Strand wrote back in early June, and the title is "We Will Crush You," and it talks about a number of colleges are launching roving bias response teams in order to filter free speech. And there's obviously a reference here, major references to Speech First and to the University of Michigan case. Maybe tell us more about the University of Michigan case and what that's all about.
Sure. So we filed suit against University of Michigan on May 8th, alleging that through a combination of two very bad policies, a broad and very vaguely worded speech code, and then this policy called the bias response team, that students' First and 14th Amendment rights were being infringed, because bullying, harassing, discrimination was very broadly worded, so that students didn't know what they could be in trouble for. It really put the onus on the listener to determine what was negative speech. And that, when you're in a situation like that, you end up tailoring, students have to tailor their language down to what the most sensitive student on campus might interpret their remarks to. You know, there's no mens rea, there's not what I meant to say, it is how somebody might have heard what you said.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bias response team is an interesting policy in that there is a portal on the university website where students could report anonymously the speech of their fellow students, and then it would be investigated by a bias response team, which was made up of college administrators as well as university police. The bias on the website was defined very broadly as well. So we are currently in the stage of litigation where we filed briefs back and forth, and we have a hearing in Michigan on July 31st to determine if our motion for a preliminary injunction against the bias response team will be allowed to will be granted. So it's still very much in a wait and see mode, but we look forward to seeing what the courts have to say about it.
Mm-hmm. In the filing. There was a number of interesting paragraphs, but On the bottom of page 4, the last paragraph, it says, imagine that in the wake of the September 11th attacks, a public university established a patriotism response team to foster a sufficiently patriotic campus climate. If a student witnessed anti-American behavior on campus, he or she could file a report and receive counseling and support about how to cope with unpatriotic actions. When you look at this response team approach that is in place at the University of Michigan, as you look at these response teams, how do you or can you even do away with personal interpretation that a person has? And then how does that relate to a university having a policy in place where someone is going to be punished because they have responded in a negative way, opposite of how the university, in this case, wants you to respond?
Yeah, it's unusual, and it's funny. I mean, because when I tell people about it, they say, you know, this can't be real. This is, I mean, it does sound like it's something out of 1984. It is very Orwellian. I think it's very difficult to have a system where you can report speech that you overhear and not have a chilling effect. And that's what we're most concerned with here, is a chilling effect. Because students are scared of possible repercussions, they just don't speak or act altogether. And that's not, again, that's just not a real educational experience. I mean, sadly, this is not a phenomenon that is limited only to the University of Michigan. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education had a report that came out last year, and they identified 231 schools across the country that have policies like this in place. Some schools have moved things around. They played kind of a shell game. The University of Northern Colorado no longer has an active bias response team, but they have reassigned all the people who worked on that project to a different department that still accepts complaints. And so it is having just these systems in general where you can, frankly, tattletale on another student, where you, even though you might not like it, the speech that is being expressed is constitutionally protected, is it's really scary. And it's just another way that you can, that universities are clamping down on disfavored yet protected speech.
Mm-hmm. In that same article by Paul Strand, you're quoted as saying that college is not meant to be a safe space. College is meant to be a place for discourse, where you exchange ideas, where you pursue truth. It is not meant to be a place where you are coddled. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Sure. I mean, I'm not sure if you have heard of a group called Heterodox Academy.
Yes.
It's a project run by Jonathan Haidt out of NYU. Mm-hmm. And I saw him give a presentation a few years ago, and he predicted, frankly, a coming split in academia, where there will be universities that are pursuit of truth universities. Universities, schools like the University of Chicago, that sends out a letter to their incoming freshmen, you are here to be challenged. You are not here to be, you know, protected. And if you want that, you are welcome, frankly, to find something somewhere else. Or there are those schools, and then there will be social justice schools, schools like Evergreen, schools like Reed College, where it is, I mean, a bit of a probably rude thing to say, but it's almost the inmates running the asylum, where it's that you know what you get into, but you're not going to be challenged. You will be surrounded by a bunch of people who think the way you do and who will bend and acquiesce to your demands. But, I mean, looking at the cost of college now, if you're paying $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, and you're not even getting to challenge or question on-campus orthodoxy on issues, you know, ranging from marriage to gender to identity politics to, you know, marriage, life, I mean, that's not a real educational experience. And our students deserve better. And, I mean, I have two children now, and I told them both that they're going to have to be plumbers, because I'm not sending them to a school where they're not able to engage in spirited debate.
Mm-hmm. As a sidebar conversation, maybe if we could just shift for a second and talk about your grandparents and what happened during the Second World War.
Sure. I am half Japanese. My father is Japanese-American. He was actually born in Japan after the war, because my grandparents were both born in California. They mm-hmm. were American citizens, and they were in internment camps. They actually met in the internment camp. They met in Manzanar in California. And so to me, civil liberties has always been something that I have been very passionate about, because I know from firsthand experience, a government that is big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take it all away, because it did. Because of Executive Order 9066, signed by FDR, my grandparents' families had 48 hours to sell everything they owned, one of which was, oceanfront property in Terminal Island. They were fishermen, and that was considered a national security risk. And so when people want programs, when students want programs like bias response teams, when they want to cede a fair authority to a bureaucracy at a school, fix my problems, adjudicate my woes, I think those are rights. That's something that people used to fight for, people cherish. And so just to hand that over to someone and assume that they will always be ruling in your favor is a very dangerous and very misguided thing to me, because you're not always sure that they're going to be on your side. Think of all the people who wanted all these policies and all these bureaucracies put in place expecting the Clinton administration to be running Washington. If you want a big government agency having control over civil liberties, and then you give those keys over to the Trump administration, it's a very different thing. And so I think we always have to be on guard to keep our civil liberties, to hold them dear and really to uphold them.
There are many people who always seem to think that when there's a discussion about civil liberties and freedom of speech, that we're only talking about organizations that have more of a liberal bent. How does all that play into what Speech First is doing? And when you're looking at the freedom of speech, which is, a First Amendment right that we have, which, is irrespective of whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or liberal or conservative.
In my opinion, the First Amendment, none of the amendments, but, the First Amendment in particular, it's not a partisan issue. And it's not, and it really shouldn't be. And I think, there is probably a misconception with a lot of students, probably stemming from the fact that we just don't have great civic education anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So if the first time you really hear and understand, start to learn about the First Amendment is when you get to college, and it's to justify why white supremacists can march through your campus, of course students are going to say, I don't like the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of garbage. This is not for me. So I do think that we need to start to show students and to teach them from a much earlier age why the First Amendment is so important, that the First Amendment and the freedom of speech is something that has always been used historically. It has been often the only way that disenfranchised groups have been able to get their message out. It was, you think about speech that was disfavored in the 1800s, it was abolitionism. In the early part of the 20th century, it was suffrage, women's suffrage. In the 60s and 70s, it was, in the 1960s, 50s, anti-Jim Crow stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Martin Luther King wrote letters from a Birmingham jail, from a jail, because he had broken an anti-speech ordinance that that Alabama had at the time. And so if you are able to articulate a message and get it out to people and let people make up their minds for themselves, that is what speech is. And so to see students today that want to, that shout down opponents, that they don't want people to be able even to hear the message of speakers that they hate, be it Milo Yiannopoulos, be it Ann Coulter. That to me is fundamentally disrespectful to your fellow students. Let your fellow students listen to these speakers that
mm-hmm.
you dislike and disdain, and let them make up their minds for themselves. Frankly, a lot of these ideas don't stand up on their own, but by banning them, by shouting them down, and by censoring them, you give that speech undue power and mystique that it really, frankly, doesn't deserve. Frankly, the best thing that could happen is to have those people get their message out, have people hear how stupid, how weak it is, receive a bunch of really tough questions that they can't answer, and then, it shows that the emperor has no clothes.
Mm-hmm.
But by driving it underground, it makes it seem more dangerous and sexier than it is, and it doesn't deserve that.
Sure.
The answer to bad speech is more speech.
Sure. In closing, how can listeners find out more about Speech First, about what you do, and if they're interested in becoming a member?
Sure. If they go to speechfirst.org, speechfirst.org, they can see all our different news clips. They can read about all the case files for the University of Michigan case, and they can become a member. It's $5 to join. If they use the promotion code RADIO2018, we'll waive the $5, and they can keep the $5 for coffee or beer. because we really do want to send a message to students that there is strength in numbers, that the more the merrier, because we want students to know, look, there are thousands of Americans who believe in this. If you choose to stand up for your rights, you are doing the right thing, because there is an army of people behind you who also believe in that.
I want to thank you for being my guest on Education Matters, and hopefully we will be talking once again.
Thank you.
And in our next segment of Education Matters, we will be looking at a new program. It's called iCivics. and it was founded by former Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor. And now, Justice O'Connor.
I want to thank you for spending your valuable time trying to find new ways to bring rich and engaging civics education to your students. When I stepped down and retired from the Supreme Court, I thought that one of the most important things I could do with my newfound free time, if there was to be some, was to help the next generation become knowledgeable in civics and civic principles and as leaders. And as you well know, the knowledge of our system of government is not handed down through the gene pool. It has to be learned by every generation of citizens. And our nation's schools were established initially for the purpose of educating our young people to be good citizens. And by bringing civic education to the classroom, you're carrying out that very important mission. And to help support you in that effort, I have teamed up with some experts in technology and in education, and together we've created iCivics.org, a website, where you will find free lesson plans, interactive activities, social networking tools, and online games to excite and engage your students. You may be surprised that I'm promoting civics teaching and learning using online media. I'm not an expert in it, but these are the new tools of civic engagement for the digital generation, the young people. And even a retired cowgirl like me knows that we need to use these tools to educate if we're going to inspire and interest today's young people to become active and knowledgeable civic leaders. So I hope you'll try out the materials on the iCivics.org website. Tell us what you think and what more we can do to support you. As you know, democracy is not a spectator sport. We have to participate, each of us, to ensure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. I know you will not let that happen on your watch. Thank you.
And I'm very pleased to welcome Louise Dubé to Education Matters this morning. And Louise, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for hosting me, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be with you and the folks in Wisconsin.
Just so our audience is aware, you have your law degree from McGill University in Montreal and also an MBA from Yale University. I know you started your position in July of 2014 as Executive Director of iCivics. And we heard Justice O'Connor give a bit of the background and the importance of civics education. But I thought maybe if we could just start with maybe talking and giving our listening audience a bit of background in terms of the overall focus of iCivics from your perspective as executive director.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to do that. It's iCivics was really only an idea in Jess O'Connor's head and became a reality. We started in 2009. And I think at the beginning, you know, it was just something that was deeply important to her, but it was primarily related to the independence of judiciary. I think that's where the genesis of iCivics came from. She was on the court, and as she stepped down from the court, she retired, really felt like people didn't understand that if we elect judges, they may not be quite as independent as was originally structured in our system of government. And her solution to this was really to educate kids about our system, how it works, why you need to get involved, and what's in it for you. And as she went into this, she sort of devised this method, which you know now as educational gaming. And it's been tremendously successful. And so over the course of those years between 2009 and when I came in 2014, they gained a lot of teachers who became very excited about having access to free and quality civic education resources in a way that kids would actually want to do. So the whole premise for iCivics is, let's put the students in the center of the action. Let's make sure that kids not only fill out a worksheet about what are the three branches of government, but let them become president of the United States for a time, try to try it out, try to see what it takes to be a president, see what kind of issues come to your desk, and then see if they can actually achieve their goals as president. Same thing with our game, Win the White House. Students run their own campaign for the presidency. They create their candidate, they create their platform, they have to defend their platforms with specific projects, they have to run a primary, they have to raise money, they have to put in appearances all over the country, and then over the course of many weeks, they either win the election or they don't. So that's what, when I came in 2014, there had been quite a bit of adoption. But really, we hadn't told enough people about what iCivics was and why this was really very important. So that's what we tried to do. We tried to create a strategic plan and try to spread the word across multiple channels, either through media. We had an article in the New York Times, through conversations like this one, through letting teachers know all of the thousands of resources we have on the iCivics site so that they can make deeper and better use of it. And so we've been fairly successful. We've had over 20% increases in the traffic at iCivics year over year ever since then. And so we're really thrilled. Now, last year we had about 4 million kids on iCivics. And this year is crazy. I mean, with the election, we have seen increases of 40% in some days, some weeks, as related to teachers and students looking for resources about the election. So I think we'll definitely be up more than 20% again this year.
Mm-hmm. One of the quotes from Justice O'Connor that's actually on your website, she says, "The practice of democracy is not passed down through the gene pool. It must be taught and learned anew by each generation of citizens." As you think about those words, and as I mentioned to you before we started taping, that I actually use iCivics in my graduate school law course at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. Why do you think there is a lack of civic education in this country?
Originally, I mean, this line is probably my favorite line, the one you selected, Steve, from Jess O'Connor. It really was the original mission of schools, right? I think most of us know that is why we created schools. And we wanted to teach kids how to be responsible and engaged citizens and knowledgeable citizens. And we've really gotten away from that. It's a confluence of factors that have led to this. And would take quite a while to untangle, but just to talk about a few of them, we've really seen a push, sort of an unintended consequence of this sort of education reform movement. We went back to the basics of ELA and math, and these are all fantastic disciplines, and everybody is supportive of that. But as a consequence, And the culture of accountability, district administrators started to take time away from other disciplines to focus on those that are tested, right? I think that's a normal response, and one which has been very difficult for social studies. And I think really to the detriment of a generation of kids. So that pressure is definitely been felt, but even worse, within the social studies environment, civics itself, with very weak mandates. Almost every state has mandates for civic education of one kind or another, but they're very weak mandates. They're not tested for the most part. They're either in middle school or in high school, not necessarily both. And they are usually not a full course. They're part of a course. It's very easy to sort of follow them by the strict letter of the law, but not with the spirit that was intended. And so we've seen two two separate issues here. One is that there's less civic education, and the second one is that there is a huge disparity in the quality of civic education that is directly related to income levels. And that, both of those are huge concerns for us. That's why we're committed to keeping iCivics free. But even with that, there is just quite a bit of out-of-school activities and civic-related activities that kids with more means get more of, and kids with fewer means get less of. So I think we've seen that trend over a number of years. I'm hoping that we're at the cusp of seeing it turn around. I think what's happening in the world right now is an indication of the interest in people coming back to what it means to be a citizen, what it means to be informed about politics and political issues, what it means to know how our institutions work, and also what it means to have a civil discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of those things are that have occurred have opened up people's eyes. And I will add one more thing. I think even beyond that, I think even corporations that are looking for able workers and who would have supported math and ELA as the core, the fundamental pieces of training kids, realize that in our next century, kids are going to have to solve very, very complicated problems. Problems that require judgment, requires working across with people that you may not agree with. These are all the kinds of things that a civic education will train you for. And that is why it's so very important not to stray from civic education in schools.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned before that you've seen an increase in the online usage, if you will, but particularly during this presidential election cycle. And I think regardless of where someone sits or stands, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, this has certainly been a most unusual election cycle. When you look at the dialogue that we see taking place around the country, what impact, if any, do you think this is having on our public or private school students right now in our country?
I think it's relatively complex, and we don't really know yet. What I can assure you of is that kids are very, very interested. They would like to have discussion. Circle did a survey on this. Circle, I refer to the group, the research arm at Tufts University, does a lot of research into civic life, and particularly in terms of youth voting and civic education. They did a survey, and they really found that that teachers would love to do this and to teach, and that kids are very interested. But there's a lot of pushback right now because of the polarization to support teachers, and teachers are very afraid. I don't know exactly what it's like in Racine or Kenosha, but I do know that in some, particularly in purple states, some superintendents have specifically said to their teachers, do not teach the election, because parents will not back them up.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge problem. It's a huge problem for us, and we think it's simply not understanding how our democracy works. I think it's very important, because I think the kids are paying attention. I think they need to understand that there are institutions and that they work a certain way and that we have a historical basis. They need to learn the history of how these came about, and we need to let them talk.
Sure.
And let them take positions and have a discussion on controversial issues. And those are, part of the six best practices in civic education. We need to support that. We need to stand up for, as educators, for that proposition. But if you're asking the long-term consequences of this, I hope that one of the long-term consequences will be that folks will understand how important civic education is, and that we'll see a movement go back the other way. I don't know if it will have an impact on kids in terms of voting. There's a lot of short-term memories.
Mm-hmm.
But I do hope it will engage them in you know, during the course of this election, there were many times where the rules of the election became actually, you know, very actively discussed. Those kinds of topics, if fostered by the teacher in the classroom, can really lead to long-term engagement with the process, right? They understand more, so they pay attention more long-term. That's our goal. Our goal is to get them early, get them to understand, and then hopefully down the line, they'll pay more attention to political information.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you mentioned research. I was fascinated with the research that was done at Baylor University by Lecompte Moore and Blevins, The Impact of iCivics on Student Core Civic Knowledge, and it's a publication from 2011. And by the way, for our listeners, if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Louise Dubay, who's executive director of iCivics. This is a free online civics education program. It was created by former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And we're talking about the iCivics program, and that you can find it on the internet at iCivics.org. The research that I just mentioned at Baylor University, I found it fascinating in that the fourth grade students particularly, they found that if these students are exposed or spent at least 30 minutes on iCivics and on the Your Interactive website at least twice a week for at least 30 minutes, that there was a significant improvement in their achievement test scores when it came to the subtests that they would take with regards to civics. And these test scores, and this was part of the study that they did. As you look at other studies and you look at the overall impact of iCivics, how do you go about actually evaluating how effective iCivics is long-term?
Yeah, so we've done a number of different studies along those lines. So one is on civic knowledge. Do they know more about how our government works and how to be how the rule of law works, or in specific cases at the Supreme Court? And so we've worked with independent academic institutions that have fielded studies. And so we've been able to demonstrate that. We've also been able to demonstrate that students are better able to write essays, argumentative essays, as a result of going through our tools, specifically our drafting board tool. We've also documented that if they're exposed to our games, just about half of them will go back and play the games on their own unprompted, which is really nice because we know what they're doing when they're not, you know, doing something like that on their free time. They'll be doing other less productive activities. So I was really thrilled to see that kids actually love playing the games, even outside of school. So what we try to do is to work with academic to field studies. They're all independent, and so we don't pay for these things. But when they are able to get grant money, we support them. There's a more recent Baylor study that's coming out and is actually going to document the fact that after they play our games and are exposed to some action civics curriculum, which is how to get involved in the real world, they are more likely to indicate that they would like to be more involved in the real world later, pre and post test.
Mm-hmm.
So that was also really gratifying. So that's what we do. We try to work with different academic institutions to demonstrate that we have a long-term impact on the knowledge, the ability to write, and the long-term engagement with our democracy after they're finished iCivics. So we think it's not only while they do it, it's really much for the rest of their lives, because there's a lot of academic research about if you get a quality civic social studies education, you're more likely to graduate from college and to get good employment. And so that's what we're trying to do.
As you look to the future, what are some new projects that you are looking at in terms of iCivics that, especially after this current election cycle?
So the first one, and we're pretty excited about this, so I hope your listeners will take a look at it. We are releasing a new executive command game. So we have executive command is the game in which the students become president and try to pass bills with the Congress and get declarations of war and sort of do all the things that a president would do. So we're revamping that game so that it can be used on tablets and as an app.
Mm-hmm.
And updating it with a lot new information and new, more international bent. We have more international conflict as we live in a global world. So that will release in early November, right after the election on November 9th. And then after that, you know, we hope that that teachers will use it. And then after that, we are beginning to work on Spanish. So we know we have a lot of English language learners out there who could benefit from having you know, English language supports for what is really very difficult vocabulary in some cases. So we're going to try to adapt our resources to Spanish-speaking English language learners.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bit longer term. And then, as I mentioned before, we're building out this primary source reading tool called DBQuest.
Sure. And finally, if any of our listeners, after listening to this interview and going on to your website at iCivics.org, if they want to get involved, if they want to get engaged, how do they do this?
Well, thanks so much for that question. Yeah, so there are different levels of involvement. If you know, the first thing to do is to look at our games and hopefully assign them to your kids if you're teaching in the classroom right now. There are lots of opportunities for educators to get more involved with us. We are currently recruiting for our educator network group. The educator network is really a group of about 30 educators all over the country that get trained additionally. They get professional development. They get a lot of resources from us, and they also blog. They host webinars. They host visitors. They do a lot of things for us. We work together, and those are our most enthusiastic supporters, and we love our educator network. And then ultimately, you know, obviously we are entirely free, and so we raise every dollar every year. We're a small staff of 12 people, and all over the country, every 50 state. And so, you know, we have a donate page on icivits.org, and we will really appreciate your support. It's you know, because we're so successful, is actually a more difficult problem in that we have to keep reinvesting in our technology and our, you know, our materials for teachers.
Well, I want to thank you for taking your time and talking to us about iCivics, and I know that this has been started out as a dream of Justice O'Connor. Louise Dubé, thank you so much for all the work that you and your staff and all the members of your governing board, which of course includes Justice O'Connor, along with current Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and of course others who are on your governing board, for being my guest this morning on Education Matters.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really enjoyed the opportunity to talk with you and your guests and your listeners, sir.
And I would like to thank my guest this morning here on Education Matters. In segment one, my guest was Nicole Neely, who is the director of a new organization called Speech First, and they look at the freedom of speech for students at both the university level and in our public schools. And in segment two, a replay of a previous show in which my guest was Louise Dubé, and she is the executive director of iCivics, a wonderful organization that was founded by former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. For Education Matters, here on WGTD HD, I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Hello, I'm Orson Welles. We know a remote farm in Walworth where Mrs. Buckley lives. In July, peas grow there. Do you really mean that? I don't understand. We aren't even in the fields yet, you see.
Yes, we are, Mr. Wells.
We are talking about them growing. She's already picked them, and we have a big bowl of hot peas with warm butter drizzled all over them. That's what we have.
Yes, Mr. Wells, in July, where fields are covered with snow. And, Mr. Wells, you need to emphasize the word in.
Why? That doesn't make any sense. I have never heard anyone who would emphasize the word in. There is no known way in the English language where you begin a sentence with the word in and then emphasize it.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes, always. I'm already past that. In fact, give me a jury and show me how you can say in July and I will sing a song.